Blue Mars, Cassette 16. Invested capital, expertise, trade. This was the carrot, and a big one. Clearly, if the Galileans accepted it, the tendrils of association with Mars would be there, and Jackie could then follow that up with political alliances of various sorts, and pull the Jovian moons into her web. This eventuality was as clear to the Jovians as it was to anyone, however, and they were doing what they could to get what they wanted without giving too much in return. No doubt they would soon be playing the Martians off against similar offers from the Terran Ex-Medes and other organizations. This was where Zoe came in. She was the stick. Public carrot, private stick. This was Jackie's method in all phases of life. Zoe revealed Jackie's threats in tiny indirect glimpses to make them seem even more threatening. Brief meeting with officials from Io. The eco-poetic plan, Zoe said to them casually, seemed far too slow. It would be thousands of years before their bacteria chewed the sulfur into useful gases, and meanwhile Jupiter's intense radio field, which enveloped Io and added to its problems, would mutate the bacteria beyond recognition. They needed an ionosphere. They needed water. It was possible they even needed to think about pulling the moon out into a higher orbit around their great gas god. Mars, home of terraforming expertise and the healthiest, wealthiest civilization in the solar system, could help them with all that, give them special help. Or even discuss with the other Galileans the notion of taking over the project in order to bring it up to speed. After that, casual conversations with various authorities from the Ice Galileans. In cocktail parties after workshops, in bars after the parties, walking in groups along Lake Geneva's signature lakefront promenade, under the sonoluminescent streetlights suspended from the tent framework. The delegates from Io, she told these people, are looking into cutting a separate deal on their own. They had the situation with the most potential when all was said and done, hard ground to stand on, heat, heavy metals. Great tourist potential. Zoe ventured that they seemed to be willing to use these advantages to strike out on their own and fractionate the Jovian League. Anne followed Zoe and the others on some of these walks, and Zoe let her listen in on a couple of the conversations, curious to see what she would make of them. She followed them down the waterfront promenade, which was set on the low meteor crater rim they had used to contain the lake. The slosh craters here beat any slosh crater on Mars by a long shot. The icy rim of this one was only a few meters higher than the general surface of the moon, forming a round levee from which one could look over the water of the lake, or back onto the grassy streets of the town, or beyond the streets to the rubbly ice plain outside the tent, visibly curving to the nearby horizon. The extreme flatness of the landscape outside the tent gave an indication of its nature. A glacier covering a whole world. Ice 1,000 kilometers deep. Ice which ate every meteor impact and tidal cracking and quickly flowed back to flatness again. On the surface of the lake, small black waves formed interference patterns on the flat sheet of water, which was white like the lake's ice bottom, tinted yellow by the great ball of Jupiter looming gibbous overhead. All its bands of creamy yellow and orange visibly swirled at their edges and around the pinprick lanterns. They passed a line of wooden buildings. The wood came from forested islands, floating around like rafts on the far side of the lake. Street grass gleamed greenly, and gardens grew in oversized planter boxes behind the buildings under long, bright lamps. Zoe showed a bit of the stick to their companions on the walk, confused functionaries from Ganymede. She reminded them of Mars's military might, mentioned again that Io was considering defection from their league. The Ganymedeans went off to get dinner, looking dismayed. "So subtle," Anne remarked when they were out of earshot. "Now we're being sarcastic," Zoe said. "You're a thug. Put it that way. I'll have to enroll in the Red School of Diplomatic Subtlety. perhaps arrange for assistants to come along with me and blow up some of their property. Anne made a noise between her teeth. She continued down the promenade, and Zoe kept up with her. "Strange that the great red spot is gone," Zoe remarked as they crossed a bridge over a white-bottomed canal. "Like some kind of sign. I keep expecting it to come around into view." The air was chill and damp. The people they passed were mostly of Terran origin, part of the diaspora. Some flyers cut lazy spirals up near the tent frame. Zoe watched them cross the face of the great planet. Anne stopped frequently to inspect cut surfaces of rock, ignoring the town on ice and its crowds, with their tiptoe grace and their rainbow clothing, a gang of young natives greyhounding past.
"You really are more interested in rocks than people," Zoe said, half admiring, half irritated.
Anne looked at her. Such a basilisk glare. But Zoe shrugged and took her by the arm, pulled her along.
"The young natives out here are less than 15 M years old. They've lived in 0.1 G all their lives. They don't care about Earth or Mars. They believe in the Jovian moons, in water, in swimming and flying. Most of them have altered their eyes for the low light. Some of them are growing gills. They have a plan to terraform these moons that will take them 5,000 years. They're the next step in evolution, for Ka's sake. And here you are staring at rocks that are just the same as rocks everywhere else in this galaxy. You're just as crazy as they said."
This bounced off Anne like a thrown pebble. She said, "You sound like me when I tried to get Nadia away from Underhill." Zoe shrugged.
"Come on," she said. "I have another meeting."
Mafia work never stops, does it? But she followed, peering around like a wizened court jester, dwarfish and oddly dressed in her old-fashioned jumper. Some Lake Geneva Council members greeted them, somewhat nervously, by the docks. They got on a small ferry which threaded its way out through a fleet of small sailing boats. Out on the lake it was windy. They puttered to one of the forest islands. Vast specimens of balsa antique stood over the swampy mat of the floating island's heated ground, and on the island's shore, loggers were working outside a little sawmill. The mill was soundproof. Nevertheless, a muffled whine of saw cuts accompanied the conversation. Floating on a lake on a moon of Jupiter, all the colors suffused with the gray of solar distance. Zoe felt little bursts of flyer's exhilaration, and she said to the locals,
"This is so beautiful. I can see why there are people on Europa who talk about making their whole world a water world, sail around and around. They could even ship away water to Venus and get down to some solid land for islands. I don't know if they've mentioned it to you. Maybe it's just all talk, like the idea I heard for creating a small black hole and dropping it into Jupiter's upper atmosphere. Stellarizing Jupiter. You'd have all the light you needed then."
"Wouldn't Jupiter be consumed?" one of the locals asked.
"Oh, but it would take ever so long," they said. "Millions of years."
"And then a nova," Anne pointed out.
"Yes, yes, everything but Pluto destroyed. But by that time, we'll be long gone one way or another. Or if not, they'll figure something out."
Anne laughed harshly. The locals, thinking hard, didn't appear to notice. Back on the lake shore, Anne and Zoe walked the promenade.
"You're so blatant," Anne said. "On the contrary, it's very subtle. They don't know if I'm speaking for me, or for Jackie, or for Mars. It could be just talk. But it reminds them of the larger context. It's too easy for them to get wrapped up in the Jovian situation and forget all the rest. The solar system entire, as a single political body. People need help thinking about that. They can't conceptualize it."
"You need help yourself. It's not Renaissance Italy, you know."
"Machiavelli will always remain true, if that's what you mean. And they need to be reminded of that here."
"You remind me of Frank."
"Frank?"
"Frank Chalmers."
"Now there's an essay I admire," Zoe said. "What I've read about him, anyway. He was the only one of you who wasn't a hypocrite, and he was the one that got the most done.
You don't know anything about it, Anne said. Zoe shrugged.
The past is the same for all of us. I know as much about it as you do.
A group of the Jovians walked by, pale and big-eyed, utterly absorbed by their own talk. Zoe gestured.
Look at them. They're so focused. I admire them, too, really. Throwing themselves so energetically into a project that won't be completed until long after their death. It's an absurd gesture. A gesture of defiance and freedom, of divine madness, as if they were sperm wiggling madly toward an unknown goal.
That's all of us, Anne said. That's evolution. When do we go to Miranda? Around Uranus, 4 times as far from the sun as Jupiter, objects were struck by 0.25% the light that would have struck them on Earth. This was a problem for powering major terraforming projects, although, as Zoe found when they entered the Uranian system, it still provided quite enough illumination for visibility. The sunlight was 1,300 times as bright as the full moon on Earth, the sun still a blinding little chip in the black array of stars, and though things in the region were a bit dim and drained of their color, one could see them perfectly well. Thus the great power of the human eye and spirit, functioning well so far from home. But there were no big moons around Uranus to attract a major terraforming effort. Uranus's family consisted of 15 very small moons, none larger than Titania and Oberon at 600 kilometers in diameter, and most considerably smaller. A collection of little asteroids, really, named after Shakespeare's women, for the most part, all circling the blandest of the gas giants, blue-green Uranus, rolling around with its poles in the plane of the ecliptic, its 11 narrow graphite rings, scarcely visible fairy loops. All in all, not a promising system for inhabitation. Nevertheless, people had come, people had settled. This was no surprise to Zoe. There were people exploring and starting to build on Triton, on Pluto, on Charon. And if a 10th planet were discovered and an expedition sent out to it, they would no doubt find a tent town already there, its citizens already squabbling with each other, already bristling at any suggestion of outside interference in their affairs. This was life in the diaspora. The major tent town in the Uranian system was on Oberon, the biggest and farthest out of the 15 moons. Zoe and Anne and the rest of the travelers from Mars parked in a planetary orbit just outside Oberon and took a ferry down to the moon to make a brief visit to the main settlement. This town, Hippolyta, spanned one of the big groove valleys that were common to all the larger Uranian moons. Because the gravity was even more meager than the light was dim, the town had been designed as a fully three-dimensional space, with railings and glide ropes and flying dumbbell waders, cliffside balconies and elevators, chutes and ladders, diving boards and trampolines, hanging restaurants and plinth pavilions, all illuminated by bright white floating lamp globes. Zoe saw immediately that so much paraphernalia in the air made flying inside the tent impossible. But in this gravity, daily life was a kind of flight. And as she bounded in the air with a flex of her foot, she decided to join those residents who treated daily life that way. She danced. And in fact, very few people tried to walk in the Terran way. Here, human movement was naturally airborne, sinuous, full of vaulting leaps and spinning dives and long Tarzan loops. The lowest level of the city was netted. The people who lived out here came from everywhere else in the system, although, of course, they were mostly Martian or Terran. At this point, there were no native Uranians, except for a single creche of young children who had been born to mothers building the settlement. 6 moons were now occupied, and recently they had dropped a number of gas lanterns into the upper atmosphere of Uranus to swim in rings around its equator. These now burned in the planet's blue-green like pinpricks of sunlight, forming a kind of diamond necklace around the middle of the giant. These lanterns had increased the system's light enough
so that everyone they met in Oberon remarked on how much more color there was in things, but Zoe was not impressed.
"I'd hate to have seen it before," she said to one of the local enthusiasts.
"It's Monochromo Mundos." Actually, all the buildings in the town were brightly painted in broad swathes of color, but which color a swathe happened to be was sometimes beyond Zoe's telling. She needed a pupil dilator. But the locals seemed to like it. Of course, some of them spoke of moving on after the Uranian towns were finished, out to Triton, the next great problem, or Pluto or Charon. They were builders. But others were settling in here for good, giving themselves drugs and genetic transcriptions to adapt to the low G, to increase the sensitivity of their eyes, etc. They spoke of guiding in comets from the Oort cloud to provide water, and perhaps forcing two or three of the smaller uninhabited moons to collide, to create larger and warmer bodies to work with, artificial Mirandas, as one person called them. Anne walked out of that meeting, or rather pulled herself along a railing, unable to cope with the mini-G. After a while, Zoe followed her onto streets covered with luxuriant green grass. She looked up. Aquamarine giant. Slender, dim rings. A cold, fey sight, unappealing by any previous human standard, and perhaps untenable in the long run because of the moonlit gravity. But back in the meeting, there had been Uranians praising the planet's subtle beauties, inventing an aesthetics to appreciate it, even as they planned to modify everything they could. They emphasized the subtle shades of the colors, the cool warmth of the tented air, the movements so like flight, like dance in a dream. Some of them had even become patriots to the point of arguing against radical transformation. They were as preservationist as this inhospitable place could logically sustain. And now some of these preservationists found Anne. They came up to Anne in a group, standing in a circle around her to shake her hand, hug her, kiss the top of her head. One got down on his knees to kiss her feet. Zoe saw the look on Anne's face and laughed.
"Come on,"
she said to the group, who apparently had been assigned a kind of guardian status for the moon Miranda. The local version of Reds sprung into existence out here where it made no sense at all, and long after redness had ceased to be much of an issue even on Mars. But they flowed or pulled themselves into position around a table set out in the middle of the tent on a tall, slender column, and ate a meal as the discussion ranged all over the system. The table was an oasis in the dim air of the tent, with the diamond necklace in its round jade setting shining down on them. It seemed the center of town, but Zoe saw suspended in the air other such oases, and no doubt they seemed like the center as well. Hippolyta was a small town, but Oberon could hold scores of towns like it, and so would Titania, Ariel, Miranda. Small as they were, these satellites all had surfaces covering hundreds of square kilometers. This was the attraction of these sun-forsaken moons. Free land, open space. A new world, a frontier, with its ever-receding chance to start new, to found a society from scratch. For the Uranians, this freedom was worth more than light or gravity. And so they had gathered the programs and the starter robots and taken off for the high frontier with plans for a tent and the Constitution to be their own first hundred. But these were precisely the kind of people least interested in hearing about Jackie's plans for a system-wide alliance, and already there had been local disagreements strong enough to have caused trouble. Among the people sitting around the table were some serious enemies, Zoe could tell. She watched their faces closely as the head of their delegation, Marie, laid out the Martian proposal in the most general terms. An alliance designed to deal with the massive historical economic numerical gravity well of Earth, which was huge, teeming, flooded, mired in its past like a pig in a sty, and still the dominant force in the diaspora. It was in the best interests of all the other settlements to band with Mars and present a united front in control of their own immigration, trade, growth, in control of their destinies. Except none of the Uranians, despite their arguments with each other, looked at all convinced.
An elderly woman who was the mayor of Hippolyta spoke, and even the Mirandan Reds nodded. They would deal with Earth on their own. Earth or Mars was equally dangerous to freedom. Out here, they planned on dealing with all potential alliances or confrontations as free agents, in temporary collusion or opposition with equals, depending on circumstances. There was simply no need for any more formal arrangements to be made. "All that alliance stuff smacks of control from above," the woman concluded. "You don't do it on Mars. Why try it out here?" "We do it on Mars," Marie said. "That level of control is emergent from the complex of smaller systems below it, and it's useful for dealing with problems at the holistic level, and now at the interplanetary level. You're confusing totalization with totalitarianism, a very serious error." They didn't look convinced. Reason had to be backed with leverage. That was why Zoe was along. And the application of leverage would go easier with the reasoning laid out like this beforehand. Throughout the dinner, Anne remained silent until the general discussion ended and the Miranda group began to ask her questions. Then she came alive, as if switched on, and asked them in return about current local planetology, the classification of different regions of Miranda as parts of the two colliding planetesimals, the recent theory that identified the tiny moons Ophelia, Desdemona, Bianca, and Puck as ejected pieces of the Mirandan collision, and so on. Her questions were detailed and knowledgeable. The Guardians were thrilled, in transports, their eyes as big as lemurs' eyes. The rest of the Uranians were likewise pleased to see Anne's interest. She was the Red. Now Zoe saw what that really meant. She was one of the most famous people in history, and it seemed possible that all the Uranians had a little red in them. Unlike the settlers of the Jovian and Saturnian systems, they had no plans for large-scale terraforming. They planned to live in tents and go out on the primal rock for the rest of their lives. And they felt, at least its Guardian group felt, that Miranda was so unusual that it had to be left entirely alone. That was a red idea, of course. Nothing humans did there, one of the Iranian Reds said, would do anything but reduce what was most valuable about it. It had an intrinsic worth that transcended even its value as a planetological specimen. It had its dignity. Anne watched them carefully as they said this, and Zoe saw in her eyes that she didn't agree or even quite understand. For her, it was a matter of science. For these people, a matter of spirit. Zoe actually sympathized more with the locals' view than Anne's, with its cramped insistence on the object. But the result was the same. They both had the red ethic in its pure form. No terraforming on Miranda, of course. Also, no domes, no tents, no mirrors. Only a single visitor's station and a few rocket pads, though this too appeared to be controversial within the Guardian group. A ban on anything except no-impact foot travel and rocket hops high enough over the surface to avoid disturbing the dust. The Guardian group conceived of Miranda as wilderness, to be walked through but never lived on, never changed. A climber's world, or even better, a flyer's world, looked at and nothing more. A natural work of art. Anne nodded at all this, and there it was. Something more in her than the crimping fear. A passion for rock in a world of rock. Fetishes could fix on anything, and all these people shared the fetish. Zoe found it peculiar to be among them, peculiar and intriguing. Certainly her leverage point was coming clear. The Guardian group had arranged a special ferry to Miranda to show it to Anne. No one else would be there. A private tour of the strangest moon of all for the strangest red. Zoe laughed.
"I'd like to come along," she said earnestly.
And the great No said yes. That was Anne on Miranda. It was the smallest of Uranus's five big moons, only 470 kilometers in diameter. In its early years, some 3.5 billion years before the present, its smaller precursor had run into another moon of about the same size. The two had shattered, then clumped, then, in the heat of the collision, coalesced into a single ball. But the new moon had cooled before the coalescing was quite finished. The result was a landscape out of a dream, violently divergent and disarranged. Some regions were as smooth as skin, others were ripped raw. Some were metamorphosed surfaces of two proto-moons, others were exposed interior material. And then there were the deeply grooved rift zones, where the fragments met imperfectly. In these zones, extensive parallel groove systems bent at acute angles, in dramatic chevron formations, a clear sign of the tremendous torques involved in the collision. The big rifts were so large that they were visible from space as hack marks incised scores of kilometers deep into the side of the gray sphere. They came down on a plateau next to the biggest of these hacked chasms, called Prospero's Rift. They suited up, then left the spacecraft and walked out to the rift's edge. A dim abysm, so deep that the bottom looked to be on a different world. Combined with the airy micro-G, the sight gave Zoe the distinct feeling of flying. Flying, however, as she sometimes did in dreams. All Martian conditions suspended in favor of some sky of the spirit. Overhead, Uranus floated full and green, giving all of Miranda a jade tinge. Zoe danced along the rim, pushing off on her toes and floating, floating, coming down in little pliés, her heart full of beauty. So strange, the diamond sparks of the gas lanterns surfing on Uranus's stratosphere, the eldritch jade. Lights hung across a round green paper lantern, the depths of the abysm only suggested. Everything glowing with its own internal greenness, Viriditas bursting out of everything, and yet everything still and motionless forever, except for them, the intruders, the observers. Zoe danced. Anne hiked along much more comfortably than she had in Hippolyta, with the unconscious grace of someone who has spent a lot of time walking on rock. Boulder ballet. She carried a long angular hammer in her thick glove, and her thigh pockets bulged with specimens. She didn't respond to the exclamations of Zoe or the guardian group. She was oblivious to them. Like an actor playing the part of Anne Claiborne. Zoe laughed that one could become such a cliché. If they domed this dark backward and abysm of time, it would make a beautiful place to live, she said. Lots of land for the amount of tent needed, eh? And such a view. It would be a wonder. No response to such a blunt provocation, of course. But it would set them thinking. Zoe followed the guardian group like an albatross. They had started descending a broken staircase of rock that lined the edge of a slim buttress, extending far out from the chasm wall like a fold of drapery in a marble statue. This feature ended in a flat swirl several kilometers out from the wall and a kilometer or more lower than the rim. After the flat spot, the buttress fell away abruptly, in a sheer drop to the chasm floor some 20 kilometers straight down. 20 kilometers! 20,000 meters, some 70,000 feet. Even great Mars itself could boast no such wall. There were a number of buttresses and other deformations on the wall similar to the one they were hiking out on, flutings and draperies, as in a limestone cavern, but formed all at once. The wall had been melted, molten rock had dripped into the abyss until the chill of space had frozen it forever. Everything was visible from every point of their descent. A railing had been bolted to the buttress's edge, and they were all clipped to this railing by lines, connected to harnesses in their spacesuits. A good thing, as the edge of the buttress was narrow, and the slightest slip sideways could launch one out into the space of the chasm. The spidery little spacecraft that had dropped them off was going to fly down and take them off at the bottom of the staircase, from the flat spot at the end of the buttress promontory, so they could descend without a worry for the return, And descend they did, for minute after minute, in a silence that wasn't at all companionable. Zoe had to grin. You could almost hear them thinking black thoughts at her. The grinding was palpable. Except for Anne, who was stopping every few meters to inspect the cracks between their rough stairs.
"This obsession with rock is so pathetic," Zoe said to her on a private band. "To be so old and still so small. To limit yourself to the world of inert matter. A world that will never surprise you, never do a single thing, so that you won't be hurt. Aerology as a kind of cowardice. Sad, really."
A noise on the intercom. Air shot between front teeth.
"Disgust."
Zoe laughed.
"You're an impertinent girl," Anne said.
"Yes, I am.
And stupid as well. That I am not."
Zoe was surprised at her own vehemence. And then she saw Anne's face was twisted with anger behind her faceplate, and her voice hissed in the intercom over sharp, heavy breaths.
"Don't ruin the walk," Anne snapped. "I was tired of being ignored."
"So who's afraid now?"
"Afraid of the boredom."
Another disgusted hiss.
"You've been very poorly brought up." "Whose fault is that?"
"Oh, yours. Yours. But we have to suffer the results."
"Suffer on.
I'm the one that got you here, remember? Sax is the one who got me here, bless his little heart."
"Everyone's little to you."
"Compared to this." The movement of her helmet showed she had glanced down into the rift.
"This speechless immobility that you're so safe in.
This is the wreckage of a collision very similar to other planetesimal collisions in the early solar system. Mars had some, Earth too. That's the matrix life emerged out of. This is a window into that time, understand?"
"I understand, but I don't care."
"You don't think it matters?"
"Nothing matters in the sense you mean. There is no meaning to all this. It's just an accident of the Big Bang."
"Oh, please," Anne said.
"Nihilism is so ridiculous. Look who's talking. You're a nihilist yourself. No meaning or value to life or to your senses. A weak nihilism. Nihilism for cowards, if you can imagine such a thing."
"My brave little nihilist."
"Yes, I face it. And then enjoy what can be enjoyed."
"Which is?"
"Pleasure. The senses and their input. I'm a sensualist, really. It takes some courage, I think. To face pain, to risk death, to get the senses really roaring."
"You think you've faced pain?" Zoe remembered a stalled landing at Overlook, the pain beyond pain of broken legs and ribs.
"Yes, I have."
Radio silence. The static of the Uranian magnetic field. Perhaps Anne was allowing her the experience of pain, which, given its omnipresence, was no great generosity. In fact, it made Zoe furious.
"Do you really think it takes centuries to become human? That no one was human until you geriatrics came along?" "Keats died at 25. Have you read Hyperion? Do you think this hole in a rock is as sublime as even a phrase of Hyperion?" "Really, you, Issei, are so horrible. And you, especially. For you to judge me when you haven't changed from the moment you touched Mars."
"Quite an accomplishment, eh?"
"An accomplishment in playing dead. Anne Claiborne, the greatest dead person who ever lived."
"And an impertinent girl." "But look at the grain of this rock, twisted like a pretzel."
"Fuck the rocks."
"I'll leave that to the sensualist."
"No, look. This rock hasn't changed in 3.5 billion years. And when it did change, my lord, what a change."
Zoe looked at the jade rock under their boots. Somewhat glass-like, but otherwise utterly nondescript.
"You're obsessed," she said.
"Yes, but I like my obsessions." After that, they hiked down the spine of the buttress in silence. Over the course of the day, they descended to Bottom's Landing. Now they were a kilometer below the rims of the chasm, and the sky was a starry band overhead, Uranus fat in the middle of it, the sun a blazing jewel just to one side.
Under this gorgeous array, the depth of the rift was sublime, astonishing. Again, Zoe felt herself to be flying.
"You've located intrinsic worth in the wrong place," she said to all of them over the common band. "It's like a rainbow. Without an observer at a 23-degree angle to the light reflecting off a cloud of spherical droplets, there is no rainbow. The whole universe is like that. Our spirits stand at a 23-degree angle to the universe. There's some new thing created at the contact of photon and retina, some space created between rock and mind. Without mind, there is no intrinsic worth."
"That's just saying there is no intrinsic worth," one of the guardians replied. "It collapses back to utilitarianism, but there's no need to include human participation. These places exist without us and before us, and that is their intrinsic worth. When we arrive, we should honor that precedence if we want to be in a right attitude to the universe, if we want to actually see it."
"But I see it," Zoe said happily, "or almost see it. You people will have to sensitize your eyes with some addition to your genetic treatments. Meanwhile, it's glorious, it truly is. But that glory is in our minds."
They didn't answer. After a while, Zoe went on.
"All these issues have been raised before, on Mars. The whole matter of environmental ethics was raised to a new level by the experience on Mars, raised right into the heart of our actions. Now, you want to protect this place as wilderness, and I can see why. But I'm a Martian, and so I understand. A lot of you are Martian, or your parents were. You start from that ethical position, and in the end, wilderness is an ethical position. Terrans won't understand you as well as I do. They'll come out here and build a big casino right on this promontory. They'll cover this rift from rim to rim and try terraforming it like they have everywhere else. The Chinese are still jammed into their country like sardines, and they don't give a damn about the intrinsic worth of China itself, much less a barren moonlet on the edge of the solar system. They need room, and they see it's out here, and they'll come and build and look at you funny when you object, and what are you gonna do? You can try sabotage like the Reds did on Mars, but they can blow you off the moons here just as easy as you can them, and they've got a million replacements for every colonist they lose. That's what we're talking about when we talk about Earth. We're like the Lilliputians with Gulliver. We've got to work together and tie him down with as many little lines as we can devise."
No response from the others. Zoe sighed.
"Well," she said, "maybe it's for the best. Spread people around out here. They won't be pressuring Mars so hard. It might be possible to work out deals whereby the Chinese are free to settle out here all they want, and we on Mars are free to cut down immigration to nearly nothing. It might work rather well."
Again, no response from the others. Finally, Anne said,
"Shut up. Let us concentrate on the land here." "Oh, of course."
Then, as they were approaching the very end of the buttress, the promontory standing out in a gap of air beyond all telling, under the bejeweled jade disk and the brilliant diamond chip beyond it, the whole solar system suddenly triangulated by these celestial objects, the true size of things revealed. They saw moving stars overhead. The rocket jets of their spacecraft.
"See?" Zoe said. "It's the Chinese coming to have a look."
Suddenly, one of the guardians was on her in a fury, striking her directly on the faceplate. Zoe laughed, but she had forgotten Miranda's ultralight gravity and was surprised when a ridiculous uppercut lifted her right off her feet. Then she hit the railing with the back of her knees, spun head over heels, twisting to catch herself. Bang! A hard blow to the head, but the helmet protected her. She was still conscious, tumbling down the incline at the edge of the promontory, beyond it, the void. Fear shot through her like an electric shock. She fought for balance, but was tumbling, out of control. She felt a jolt. Ah, yes, the end of her harness. Then the sickening sensation of a farther slide down. The harness clip must have given way. second surge of adrenal fear. She turned inward and grabbed at the passing rock. Human power in 0.005G. The same gravity that had sent her flying now allowed her to catch herself by a single fingertip and bring the whole weight of her falling body to a halt, as in a miracle. She was on the edge of a long drop. Sparking lights in her eyes, nausea, darkness beyond. She couldn't see the floor of the chasm. It was like a bottomless pit, a dream image, black, falling. "Don't move," said Anne's voice in her ear. "Hold on, don't move." Above her, a foot, then legs. Very slowly, Zoe turned her head up to look. A hand clutched her right wrist hard. "Okay. There's a hold for your left hand, above it by half a meter. Higher, there. Okay, climb. You above, pull us up." They were hauled up like fish on a line. Zoe sat on the ground. The little space ferry was landing soundlessly over on a pad on the far side of the flat spot. Brief flare of light from its rockets. The concerned looks of the guardians standing over her. "Not such a funny joke," Anne suggested. "No," Zoe said, thinking hard about how she could use the incident. "Thanks for helping me." It was impressive how quickly Anne had jumped to her help. Not impressive that she had decided to, for this was the code of nobility. One had obligations to one's peers, and enemies were just as important as friends. Enemies were equals. They were necessary. They were what made it possible to be a good friend. But just as a physical maneuver, it had been impressive. "Very quick of you." On the flight back to Oberon, they were all silent until one of the ferry's crew turned to Anne and mentioned that Hiroko and some of her followers had been seen here in the Uranian system recently, on Puck. "Oh, what crap," Anne said. "How do you know?" Zoe asked. "Maybe she decided to get as far away from Earth and Mars as possible. I wouldn't blame her. This isn't her kind of place." "Maybe she doesn't know that. Maybe she hasn't heard this is your private rock garden." But Anne simply waved her away.
This ends side one of cassette 16. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.